What I'd like us to consider for a little while this morning, Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. Two men went up into the temple to pray. It might not be the kind of opening line to a story that sets your pulse racing, but don't be fooled by that. Don't write off this little tale as bland and plodding. It's nothing of the sort. It's arresting and radical and subversive. It refuses to conform. It tramples over expectations. It delivers an array of surprises. And I'm going to present to you four of those, four surprises relating to Jesus' story here. And first of all then, the effective prayer. The effective prayer. Suppose you and I were in conversation after the service and I casually remark at one point, I'm auditioning for a ballet tomorrow morning. You would struggle to keep a straight face, wouldn't you? You would struggle to hold it together. Well, good luck with that, you'd be thinking. There's more chance of seeing a pig fly across the Tyneside sky than of you getting a role in a ballet. And that's pretty much how Jesus' audience would have reacted when they heard the last few words of verse 10. So two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee. That makes sense. But it's the next bit that's on a par with my ballet audition remark. The other, a tax collector. A tax collector. At the very least, that would have provoked sniggers, perhaps even some out-and-out laughter. A tax collector going to pray? Well, good luck with that. A fat chance he has of God hearing his prayer. Why? Why is this man having his prayer heard akin to me being chosen for a ballet? Why is it so unlikely? Well, because tax collectors were dodgy characters. That's already been hinted in this gospel back in chapter 3. John the Baptist was there calling on people to repent. And a bunch of tax collectors, you remember, came up to him and asked what repentance should look like in their case. And his response was, collect no more than you're authorized to do. Chapter 3, verse 13. Which suggests that that's what they did. They demanded from taxpayers more money than was actually owed. Indeed, Luke will soon introduce his readers, won't he, to one tax collector in particular, Zacchaeus, there in chapter 19, who, following his conversion, will promise restitution to all those whom he has defrauded. That's the kind of behavior that tax collectors got up to. In verse 11 of our passage, the other temple goer in Jesus' story, the Pharisee, starts praying and he has this list of baddies that he's not like. And it could appear like a random, off the top of his head kind of list before he then suddenly notices the other guy and adds, even this tax collector. But I think actually that Matthew Henry is right. He thinks that the Pharisee is looking at the tax collector all along here and describing him all along. So he's not comparing the tax collector with extortioners, the unjust, and adulterers. He's identifying the tax collector as an extortioner, unjust, an adulterer, and probably doing so quite justifiably. But were they adulterers, you might be thinking? Extortioners, yes, we get that. Unjust, yes, we get that. But adulterers? Well, I think it's very plausible. Several times the Gospels couple tax collectors with another social group, sinners. Tax collectors and sinners, it's a recurring phrase in the Gospels. Sinners were disreputable people like prostitutes and drunkards. They were ostracized in first century Jewish society, and tax collectors, we know, were ostracized in first century Jewish society, and it seems that that common ostracism kind of pushed them together. They hung out with each other. And hanging out then with people like that at boozy parties and whatnot, it's not difficult to imagine that the tax collectors misbehaved sexually quite frequently. And so you get this point that the tax collectors then, They were dodgy characters. I said that Jesus' audience would have sniggered at the end of verse 10. Throughout verses 11 and 12, however, they would have regained their composure as they listened to the Pharisee's prayer. They would have nodded approvingly at his damning description of the tax collector. And then as Jesus in verse 13 shifts the focus to the tax collector, they would initially have continued to nod approvingly. But the tax collector, standing far off, Jesus begins. Ah, yes, they would have muttered. That's the right place for him. Judging by verse 9, Jesus' audience here includes quite a number of Pharisees. And back in chapter 16, you'll remember from the reading, his audience there also included Pharisees, probably largely the same ones in both cases, in chapter 16 and here in chapter 18. And in chapter 16, Jesus had used that same word, far off. Far off. He'd used it in verse 23 to capture the distance between Abraham in heaven and that rich man in Hades. And as some in his audience now hear Jesus use the same word that they'd heard him use in that previous passage, standing far off, they probably assume that Jesus is likening the tax collector here to that rich man in the other story. And so, as I say, they nod approvingly. You're absolutely right, Jesus. This loathsome individual is virtually in hell already. He's already got one foot there at least. He's pretty much already joined that rich man you talked about last time. He's far off, all right. Irremediably, irretrievably lost. They then listen as Jesus continues to describe the tax collector at the temple. The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God. And at that moment, the sniggers and the laughter would have erupted again. Oh my word, this idiot really is trying to pray. Doesn't he realize he's virtually in hell already, and he's trying to pray? Doesn't he realize how ineligible a man like him is to call upon God? Doesn't he realize God ain't going to hear his prayer? And yet the extraordinary thing is that God does hear his prayer. Contrary to all those assumptions and expectations among Jesus' audience, this prayer gets through. This prayer reaches God. It is effective. And I think that's worth highlighting. This passage that we're looking at clearly has links with the following material in chapter 18, and we'll talk about that later, but it has links with what precedes as well, verses 1 to 8. That's why I also included those verses in the reading. Both sections, after all, are about people praying. What specifically is the preceding section about? Well, verse 1, he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. I love that phrase, and not lose heart. And something of that probably carries over into our passage. You see, verses 2 to 8 describe one situation in which a person contemplating prayer might lose heart. In that case, it's one of the elect, verse 7, and the prayer is for justice, for ultimate justice, the second coming, effectively. And the person might just lose heart, contemplating, praying day in, day out for that. But our passage now describes another situation in which a person contemplating prayer might lose heart. In this case, it's a sinner, a guy who has made a complete mess of his life. And the prayer is for mercy. And he could look at all the skeletons in his cupboard and look at all the stains on his character, and he could just lose heart. There's no point. But verse 1 says no one contemplating prayer should lose heart. And this tax collector then, in our passage, he doesn't lose heart. He prays. He prays. Perhaps you have never cried out to God for mercy. And perhaps it's because you think you're too bad. You're too far gone. You've behaved atrociously over the years. There's no way God will listen to you. You're virtually in hell already, you think. Don't lose heart like that. You're not in hell. You're here on this earth, and as long as you're here on this earth, you can cry out to God. And irrespective of who you are, and irrespective of what you have been and what you have done, if you cry out sincerely, God will hear you. You might be the 21st century equivalent of a tax collector, a moral write-off. It doesn't matter. If you cry out sincerely, your prayer will get through. There's a way back to God from the dark paths of sin. There really is, you know. As long as you have life and breath, there's always a way back. Even from the deepest, darkest regions of depravity, there is always a way back. Don't lose heart. This tax collector wonderfully did not lose heart. He looked at himself in all his vileness, but still he prayed. Still, he hoped for a hearing from the Almighty. Still, he got a hearing from the Almighty. Don't lose heart because of how you've lived your life, but come this morning and cry out to God for mercy. The effective prayer. Secondly, the extravagant provision. The extravagant provision. The tax collector, we said, cried out for mercy, and indeed he does, but we can elaborate on that a little. Actually, the verb he uses here in the Greek has to do with propitiation. Propitiation means the removal of wrath. It's a passive form of the verb here in the man's prayer, and so Donald MacLeod suggests the translation, be propitiated towards me. God, be propitiated towards me. That's what he's requesting in this cry. Be appeased, he's saying. May your wrath, which my grievous sins have necessarily aroused, may it subside. May it be withheld and not fall as deserved upon me. And it's a daring, ambitious request then. It really is. Imagine if God were to grant it. Imagine if, after all those years of the man practicing extortion and adultery, behaviors which God thoroughly detests, imagine if God were to turn to him and say, I'm not angry with you anymore. That would be quite something, wouldn't it? So is that what he gets then? Is that what this man gets in answer to his request? I've already indicated in our first point that God hears and is responsive to the tax collector's prayer. So does he get exactly what he's asking for? A propitiated, pacified, wrath-renouncing God. It seems unlikely. I mean, surely he's been optimistic here. Surely he's going to get less than what he's asking for. Surely at best, God might be willing to give him a chance to reform his life, willing to leave open the possibility of his wrath subsiding should that reform actually happen. Surely that's the most that this man can hope for, but not a propitiated God, not a God devoid of any wrath toward him. Surely he's in cloud cuckoo land asking for that. Well, here's where the parable delivers its next surprise, because this is the thing. The tax collector doesn't get less than what he's asking for. He doesn't get less than a propitiated God. He actually gets more than that. He gets more. It's like that other story that Jesus told back in chapter 15 of this gospel, where that disgraceful son traipses back from a far country in the hope of being treated by his father as a hired servant. And that too seems like a grossly unrealistic hope. Given how wretchedly the boy has behaved, it seems certain he'll get less than that. Treated as a farm animal, perhaps, but not as a hired servant. But no, he gets more, doesn't he? He doesn't get less, he gets more than the hired servant treatment. Immeasurably more, he gets the VIP treatment. And it's similar in our passage. Look at what the tax collector gets. Verse 14, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified. Justified. I talked about that concept last Sunday evening. To be justified is to be pronounced officially not guilty. Do you see how that vastly exceeds what the man is requesting? He wishes to go back down to his house safe. Safe in relation to God. No cloud of divine wrath hanging over him. That will represent a mega successful trip to the temple. But he doesn't go home merely safe. He goes home with God's lavish commendation. With God's glowing endorsement. This man is guiltless in my sight. Jesus isn't exaggerating when he uses that other word in verse 14. Exalted. The man here, he goes home with honor. He goes home with the honor, the prestige, the kudos of unqualified divine approval. I mean, this past week, Oscar Pistorius has been in the news, hasn't he? And I guess if you're Oscar Pistorius, it's great to be able to go down to your house now, released from prison on parole. I guess for him, that's an exciting development. And this man in the story is an Oscar Pistorius. He's a blatant wrongdoer, an inexcusable wretch. And yet he doesn't go down to his house released from prison on parole. He goes down to his house with the verdict, not guilty, uttered by a smiling judge ringing in his ears. The whole atmosphere is altogether different. And this room here, is full of Oscar Pistoriuses, blatant wrongdoers, inexcusable wretches, who nonetheless have been marvelously justified. Despite our record of crimes against God, we're not here this morning on parole, the shame of all our wrongdoing still clinging to us. We're here this morning clothed in the dignity of heaven's acquittal. And if any of you isn't yet, you can be. You can be. I said in my first point this morning that however bad a person you are, you can cry out to God for mercy. And I'm saying in my second point that if you do so, you will get from God way more than you ever dreamt of in your wildest dreams. More than mercy. More than his wrath removed. More than parole, you'll get a status in the courts of heaven calculated to make the angels envious. Righteous. Righteous in the sight of God. It's the highest, noblest status conceivable. And it's given freely to stinking rebels who cry out to God like this stinking rebel did. The effective prayer, the extravagant provision. Thirdly, this morning, the excluded person. The excluded person. So the two things that we've highlighted so far would both have surprised Jesus' audience. The effective prayer, a man like this tax collector, his prayer getting through to God. And the extravagant provision, that certainly would have surprised Jesus' audience, that that man could go down to his house with this extraordinary status in his possession. But we haven't yet touched on the biggest surprise of all. It's four words in the middle of verse 14, just two words in the Greek. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Rather than the other. Many of those listening would no doubt have gasped audibly at those words. When Jesus just prior to that said, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, they would have assumed that Jesus meant he went down to his house justified, just like the Pharisee did. The Pharisee's justified status is surely just a given. What Jesus is saying is that the tax collector joined him in the possession of that status. And that was shocking enough. That was far too much for most of this audience to stomach, no doubt. But Jesus isn't saying that. He's saying that the tax collector alone of the two men went down to his house justified. That's off the scale shocking. That's unthinkably shocking. There's a kind of dark humor, I think, here in this parable. I mean, the Pharisee is deeply anxious, isn't he, to be in a separate category from the tax collector. He stands by himself, verse 11, nowhere near the other man, so that no one could possibly lump the two together. He talks about not being like the tax collector. He's desperate, as I say, to be in a separate category. And Jesus basically says in verse 14, he got what he wanted. He is in a separate category. He got his separate category, all right. He's nothing like the tax collector because the tax collector goes home justified, whereas he does not. Or perhaps we should qualify that. Actually, the Pharisee does go home justified. Because it's a bit of a motif in Luke's gospel that there's another kind of justification to the one that I've just been talking about. Back in chapter 10, verse 29, a man encounters Jesus, and we're told of him, he was desiring to justify himself. Did you notice a similar phrase in our reading earlier on in chapter 16 and verse 15? You are those who justify yourselves. So there's such a thing as a self-justification, whereby you are your own judge and you confidently declare yourself not guilty. And that's what this Pharisee is doing. That's exactly what he's doing, isn't it, in this prayer. He's looking at his own life, his own moral behavior, his own religious behavior, and his fasting and his tithing, and he's saying, you're not guilty, you're acquitted, you're fine, you're approved. So in that sense, the Pharisee does go home acquitted and approved. But the problem with that is that the court of self is not really a terribly important court at the end of the day. Imagine you come back from school on results day and you've achieved a D in GCSE maths. And you come home and you tell this to your brother or your sister, and your sibling then, trying to cheer you up, says, I think you're great at maths. Well, at that point, you don't suddenly go, really? Oh, well, that's wonderful. Everything's absolutely fine then. No, your sibling's verdict isn't really going to help, is it? It's not going to help you get onto that A-level course you want to get onto. It's not going to help you get a job later on in life. It's not your sibling's verdict you need. It's the exam board's verdict that you need. And you can say to yourself as you look in the mirror each night, as perhaps some of you do, because we're not all in that category that I mentioned earlier. We don't all feel I'm too bad to possibly cry out to God. Some of us feel we're actually pretty good. You can say to yourself as you look in the mirror each night, you're such a kind person, so helpful, so patient, so reliable. You've shown that again today, just as you did yesterday. You're a really good person. You can say that. You can give that verdict on yourself night after night after night as you look in the mirror. It's not going to help you get into heaven, because it's not your own verdict you need. It's God's verdict that you need. And this tax collector then, here in our passage, he's the first person in Luke's gospel to be justified in that court, at that level. We've had the word used already, as I've said, back in chapter 10, verse 29, back in chapter 16, verse 15. But those guys, they were only justified in the court of their own self, where they were on the judgment seat. Here at last, in Luke's gospel, we have a man in verse 14 who is justified before God in the sight of the judge, the one who sits on the real throne. Why isn't the Pharisee? Why isn't he justified? Is he lying in those claims that he makes in verses 11 and 12? Well, no and yes. I mean, Pharisees, they weren't extortioners and adulterers in the way that tax collectors were. They didn't go knocking on people's doors demanding excessive amounts of money to which they had no right. They didn't hang out with sinners at drunken parties and end up in all kinds of sexual shenanigans. But remember what we read in chapter 16 and verse 18. Remember, Jesus is addressing the Pharisees in chapter 16. That's explicit in verse 14. He's addressing the Pharisees. And he says in verse 18, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. Jesus has raised that in the Sermon on the Mount, hasn't he? You can read about that in Matthew. And the way in which these Pharisees, they twisted the law of Moses so that you could just divorce your wife at the drop of a hat, just write a certificate, give it to her, and you've kept the law of Moses. And Jesus says that's adultery. It looked a lot more respectable than what the tax collectors were doing at those drunken parties, but that was adultery. Or then verses 13 and 14 of chapter 16, where he talks about loving money in verse 13. Then it says, verse 14, the Pharisees were lovers of money. No, they didn't go around openly robbing people like the tax collectors. But internally, in their hearts, money was just as much a god, an idol, a master for them as it was for the tax collectors. And as that crucial phrase there in the middle of verse 15, God knows your hearts. God knows your hearts. God isn't just aware of the outward stuff that tax collectors get up to. The outward extortion, the outward adultery, he's also aware of the subtler, more internal forms of those sins of which the Pharisees were guilty. And this is why then you will never be justified in the court of God on the basis of your own moral goodness. You might be justified in your own court, your own little court where you're on the judgment seat, but you will never be justified in the court of God on the basis of your own moral goodness. Yes, you might be able to look at all kinds of rogues and villains out there in society who seem far, far worse than you. But really, all that distinguishes you from them is that there's a certain outward restraint in your case. But God knows your hearts, Luke 16:15 says. God knows your hearts, and he knows the cesspit of immorality that bubbles away within. We recently parked our car in Newcastle and paid for the parking by phone, and it only took a minute because the app, of course, stores all the details, all the relevant details, and so we're able to go and waltz around Newcastle, complete peace of mind. Problem was that the details related to our old car, and so we might have had complete peace of mind in the centre of Newcastle, but in the eyes of the traffic warden, looking at the car, it was parked illegally without any payment having been made. You can kind of imagine the split screen, us, complete peace of mind, the traffic warden looking at the car, shaking his head, frowning. And some of you are living this morning with a misplaced peace of mind. You think you've done enough in your life to satisfy God, get into heaven, you're fine. You haven't. It's impossible. You have a rotten heart. God doesn't recognize your moral achievements any more than the traffic warden recognized our payment. It's invalid, irrelevant. Quit exalting yourself this morning. Understand that if you continue to do that, continue to look in that mirror each night and say, you're fine, you're fine. If you continue to exalt yourself, there's going to come a dreadful, disastrous humbling, Jesus says, on the last day when you realize just how worthless and irrelevant all your moral goodness was. Understand now, before it's too late. Understand now that that verdict that you think you're hearing, it's coming from your own mouth, not from God's. And it's his verdict. It's his verdict that matters. The effective prayer, the extravagant provision, the excluded person, and then one final thing, the extra participant. The extra participants. The fourth surprise then is for the readers of Luke's gospel rather than for the original audience. So this parable then, we would all agree, it features two men. Verse 10 is explicit. So two men went up into the temple to pray. But I want to close this morning drawing your attention to a third man, the extra participant. I said that our passage connects with what follows. The subsequent verses, I think, kind of elaborate our passage. We haven't time to go into that, but the passage there with the children coming to Christ and Jesus' words, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. That relates to our passage, doesn't it? Being humbled in order to be exalted. And then the next passage about the rich ruler, and here's a man then who is able to claim like the Pharisee, I've kept all the commandments from my youth. So you can see how all of that relates to our passage. And then we come to verses 31 to 34. And Jesus there says to the 12, we are going up to Jerusalem. And that's an interesting little word connection, because remember in our passage it says two men went up to the temple to pray. So these two men, they go up to Jerusalem, up to the temple, and Jesus says, we are going up to Jerusalem, the same language. And Jesus then, I'm saying to you, is the third man. He's the third man. He's the extra participant. And he explains the other two. How is it that this vile tax collector can be justified? I mean, he hasn't obeyed God in his life. He is the wretch that the Pharisee paints him as. Well, almost certainly he is, because as I say, that's what tax collectors were like. This is a man who probably has spent his life in extortion and in adultery. So how then can he possibly receive that verdict from God? Not guilty. You're justified. You're righteous. Well, the answer is because this third man obeyed God perfectly. Willingly, we read, being delivered over to the Gentiles, being mocked, being shamefully treated, being spat upon, being flogged, being killed. He obeyed perfectly in all those ways, and the tax collector then has that obedience credited as his. That's why God can declare him righteous. Why is the Pharisee not justified? Well, because he doesn't have that perfect obedience of Jesus credited as his. He only has the rags of his own flawed obedience. It kind of parallels later passage in the Gospel, chapter 23. Where you have those two men hanging on crosses, both criminals. But one is paradise bound. The other is not. Why? What's the difference between those two criminals? They both led lives of crime. Well, again, it's because of a third man hanging on another cross. The paradise bound criminal has a saving relationship with him. The other criminal simply reviles him. Everything depends on Jesus. That's the point. Everything depends on Jesus. 2024, we're told, is going to be the biggest year of elections worldwide that there has ever been. And so nations all over the world are going to be characterized by these great political divisions, conservative and Labour, Republican and Democrat, right and left, capitalist and socialist, and so on. All these divisions are going to really come to the fore over the next 12 months. But in the last analysis, you know, there's really only one significant division which runs throughout the whole of humanity. The same division that existed between those two criminals on Good Friday. The same division that existed between the Pharisee and the tax collector. And that same division runs through this room this morning. And it's this. It's the division between those who have Jesus and those who do not. That makes all the difference in the world. And on the day when what you voted in 2024 will make no difference whatsoever, be a distant, faint, irrelevant memory, this will make all the difference in the world. Did you have Jesus or did you not? Were you on the side of the tax collector and the man we've come to know affectionately as the dying thief? Or were you on the side of the Pharisee and that other criminal who died mocking Jesus? Which side of that divide are you on? That's the difference. The tax collector is not justified on the basis of his humility. Being humble doesn't justify anybody. He's justified on the basis of Jesus and his perfect obedience being credited to him. And my question then as I close is, which side of the divide are you on? Do you have Jesus or do you not? It's the biggest question you'll hear throughout 2024. It dwarfs all other questions. Do you have Jesus or do you not? Do you have this one who obeyed so wonderfully, so sacrificially, at such cost to himself? The flogging, the spitting, the death. Do you have that obedience on your account, credited as yours? Then you have a status that nobody can surpass in the court of heaven. Or are you still depending on your own attempts to be decent? Won't get you anywhere. You're deceived. You need Jesus. Come this morning and throw yourself helplessly, like this tax collector, on the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.